Very, very pleased to welcome Dr. Steve Schofield, who has just done this report on Menmouth Hill. It's already been launched in Leeds,
Harrogate.
And this is our Sheffield launch. I think quite a lot of the people here have been. Have you been to Menmouth?
Yes.
So we've all been to Menmouth, I think. All of us haven't been there sometime, so we're sort of familiar with the place from the outside.
Great.
So, but thank you very much. It's good to have you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. I was just thinking it's about 2 or 3 years ago since I last came to Sheffield for a presentation. I was working for the campaign against the arms trade, and we did a report on control of the arms trade. And as I remember, it was quite a feisty meeting, actually. So, we've got a reputation to live up to tonight. So, what I want to do, I don't want to spend more than half an hour really talking, but basically what I want to do is just give you the background to the reason why we started the research. And then there's a slide presentation that goes through the report or some of the main elements of the report. And I'm assuming that people have a sort of a general background information. If you've been to the base, you'll know what it looks like, but not necessarily any more detailed information about what its functions are and how it actually operates as a spy base. So we'll go through that, and then we'll go through some of the investment that's been taking place in the last few years. And then we'll look at the economic case that the US authorities make about the base, which is the reason why we started the research in the first place, because they claim that the base puts hundreds of millions of pounds into the local economy, effectively. And we were very wary about some of the figures that were being produced. So we wanted to test those and challenge them. And that was the original reason why we put in the research, funding bid. But as we got into the research, it was obvious that you couldn't separate the economic arguments from the strategic functions of the base, because it functions essentially as a secret US spy base, determining the nature of the relationship between the base and the local community. So that was really how the report came together. And I should also acknowledge the work of other people in this as well. I take responsibility as the author for the report, but it was very much a collective exercise. There were lots of people who were really energised about the project and gave, you know, mainly on a voluntary basis, incredible amounts of time to the project. I felt very humble at the end of it to think that, you know, the report reflected all sorts of concerns that people had and the commitment that Yorkshire CND people had to trying to challenge the base's claims about its sort of benign strategic role and its contribution to the local economy. So that was, you know, probably the most cooperative, if you like, exercise I've ever been on, really, in terms of research. So that was good as well. Basically, you know, I've not got much affinity with computers, about the same affinity as George Osborne has with economics, I think. So I'm going to switch it on and we'll go through the slides and see how we get on, all right? But it could be the whole thing collapses, then I'll just have to rely on my natural wit, if you like. Here we go. Okay, so first deliberate mistake, I downloaded the wrong sort of heading, which is the original heading without editing it. So it says Menmouth Hill there, which is obviously wrong. But it's lifting the lid on Menmouth Hill, which is the title of the report. The strategic roles and economic impact of the US spy base in North Yorkshire. So those are the two main elements that we were interested in. To start with, I just wanted to go briefly through the history, if you like. Menmouth Hill is a signals intelligence electronic spy base run by the National Security Agency of the United States. That's the first point to make. It's not an RAF base. It's run by the biggest spy organisation in the world, the NSA. It has its headquarters at Fort Meade in Maryland, about 20 miles from Washington, D.C. And Menmouth Hill is part of a network of ground stations around the world to provide the United States with a global system for the interception of electronic communications and its analysis for intelligence purposes. Okay, so that's essentially what Menmouth Hill is. You know, you have a public relations, if you like, curtain at the front door, which is that it's an RAF base. And that's obviously from the point of view of the Ministry of Defence and the United States Department of Defence perspective important to try and project this as an equal and reciprocal relationship between the UK and the United States, but it's not. this is a base that's dominated by the United States for United States purposes. It runs a global network of interception. And all that information is channeled directly into Fort Meade near Washington for the purposes of United States military force projection. Okay. Right, let's go on to the next slide. Now, how does it do it? Well, we've all seen the radomes. We all know why they're there, more or less. But I think it's worth just pointing out exactly what the technical perspective is from the point of view of the United States. These giant receiver dishes intercept microwave signals directly transmitted from commercial satellites and those captured by the US fleet of satellites in geostationary orbit that intercept the signals that leak out into space. So there's two ways in which this NSA network actually intercepts communications from satellites. One is directly from the links that the commercial satellites make with their ground receivers on Earth. And the other is a lot of microwave signals sort of disperse into space, they leak out into space beyond the commercial satellites. So there's a whole fleet in geostationary orbit around the planet that the United States picks up. And then the key thing is that Menworth Hill is one of the regional centres that's used to download those signals from the spy satellites. So again, that's basically the way that these operate in terms of intelligence gathering. And the really important thing about Menworth Hill isn't just the radomes, but its operational capability as well. As it says there, there are teams of cryptanalysts, which is basically cipher code breakers, and linguists, and then technical specialists from some of the major arms corporations in the United States, like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Raytheon, will provide the technical background. If you can imagine this sort of complex satellite communications and links to the information technology, and then you've got these massive banks of computers in the operations center that try and analyze all this data flowing into Menworth Hill, and they look for keywords and signals and then analyze those more closely when they find a key signifier that they're interested in. And then they analyse that for intelligence purposes and send the intelligence back to Fort Meade as part of this global system. So it's a massive exercise in intelligence gathering. Okay? Right. Oh, we're doing well now. I'm getting the hang of this. Okay, so there are four main functions at Menworth Hill. And the report goes into them in a fair amount of detail. I'll just summarise them now. But essentially, there's traditional signals intelligence, or SIGINT, which we've been talking about up to now, commercial espionage, space-based infrared system, and what I've called intelligence-led warfare in the report. Now, the traditional... yes, it is an oxymoron, but then, you know, I think there's a lot of terminology in the military that's oxymorons, but why not add another one, you know? Anyway, so the traditional way that they work in terms of signals intelligence, for example, in the Cold War, they would monitor the communications between the Soviet Union, USSR, and its Warsaw Pact allies, and try and work out, you know, troop deployments, tank deployments, those sorts of things from intercepted communications. It's a bit like what Bexley Park did in the Second World War. I'm sure people all remember the Enigma code breaking and how that helped win the war in terms of identifying the position and movements of U-boats in the North Atlantic campaign. Well, it's a similar exercise, but, you know, a much more sophisticated level. And then in the two Iraq wars, what Menworth Hill would do would be monitor the electronic communications from Iraqi command and control centres and inform the military of where those centres were prior to the invasion by bombing them and taking out some of their communications. So that would be Menworth Hill's role in traditional signals intelligence, if you like. Commercial espionage is another big one that tends not to be looked at very closely for Menworth Hill. And they won't talk about it, essentially because it's illegal, obviously, so they're not going to make a big song and dance about that. But it goes on to a quite sophisticated level. We know that from the work of whistleblowers and from the European Parliament's investigation in the late 1990s and early 2000s. So the first whistleblower, if you like, was a woman called Margaret Newsham, who worked in as Bullocky in Menwith, and who's helped set up the original spying on commercial operations of European companies. And they would regularly intercept those communications on international contracts, for example, and send that information off to US-based companies for their commercial advantage. And the European investigation was called the Echelon investigation, because that was the name of the system. You know, every military spy sort of project has to have a really fancy, sexy name. This one was Echelon. There's other ones like Moonpenny, and the whole list is there if you want to go through the report. But this one was called Echelon. And it was written by Duncan Campbell. And if I had to recommend any report about Menwith Hill and the operation of the NSA in Europe, I'd recommend the reports that he did as part of the European Parliament Echelon investigation, because they're absolutely superb. Mm-hmm. At a technical level, they're superb, because they identify the value of the contracts that were lost. Mm-hmm. And it runs into billions and billions of dollars during that 1990s period, through to the actual sort of technical data about how the NSA bases in Europe operated. Not just Menwith Hill, because there were other bases. Mm-hmm. Another one in Germany called Bad Abling, which did more or less the same thing as Menwith Hill, but from a German base in Bavaria. So the report goes into detail about how commercial espionage operates for Menwith Hill. Now, they would deny it, and they have denied it in the report that was published about the presentation and the launch in Harrogate. The local paper has already got a comment back from the business saying they've never been involved in commercial spying. But that's completely contradicted by official European Parliament reports. You know, if you go back to the European Parliament for 2001, the whole Parliament endorsed the report. There was a vote of the whole European Parliament. It was a massive, overwhelming vote saying that what Menwith Hill and Bad Abling was doing was illegal. And it was possibly challenging the basis of the European Human Rights Convention in terms of the privacy of individuals as well as companies. So that was a really important exercise in democratic accountability. Now, of course, that corresponded with the events of 9/11, and the report simply disappeared in the whole changing strategic environment that resulted in, you know, after 9/11, really. It disappeared off the agenda. But I'm absolutely convinced that for the last 10 years, although there's been no investigation of commercial espionage, it's ongoing, because the Americans see their main corporations like Lockheed and Northrop as part of their security system. You know, they're absolutely vital in terms of providing weaponry. And if they're successful on an international basis, it reinforces their capacity to produce for the domestic industry, for the domestic procurement of the United States. And that's a key issue for the United States. So why wouldn't it use commercial espionage? I mean, that's the obvious question. Why not? When you're in a position to do it, which they are, and it's to their strategic advantage, what possible reason could they have for not doing it? So the denial is obviously there, because it is illegal, you know, under all sorts of international conventions about international communications. And I could give you some other examples, like Elizabeth Gunn, who's a worker at GCHQ. She was a GCHQ operative in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and she was asked by a senior NSA official in an email to help spy on the members of the Security Council. Again, illegal tapping of diplomatic communications, because they wanted a second resolution to support the war against Iraq. And she was so appalled by this, about the contrast between the official line, which was to say that they were still looking towards diplomatic negotiations with Iraq. Mm. At the same time, they were obviously preparing and committed to war and trying to pull every stop, including illegal interception of diplomatic communications, to pressurize the Security Council for a second resolution. So that's the sort of level that Menwith Hill operates on, you know. And we shouldn't pull any punches about that. You know, it's a US spy base is involved in illegal activities, and we should be clear about the scale of those illegal activities.
The changing ways that people communicate with each other at the moment, you know, from telephone to computer to computer.
Yeah.
Has that made any difference? Are they still able to do the same?
Well, there's all sorts of levels at which this operates, because partly there's been, well, obviously an increase in cable communication, so landline optic fibers. Fiber optics, which they've accessed through Menwith Hill as well. And then there are cell choke points where the fibre optic communications are interconnected with the satellite communications, especially in the United States. So they've got access to those, if you like, choke points, because they have a deal with the main internet providers that they have to have access. The NSA has access to all this information sources. We've been building a vast sort of database collection centre in Utah, precisely for that, so they can have a data storage of all that material. And I'm not a computer expert, but it runs into billions and billions and billions of bits of information that are flowing through these sensors. So those are
the sort of first two. Now, again, space-based infrared system is essentially part of the anti-ballistic missile system.
So I'm sure people know about Star Wars and that, you know, Reagan's vision of a comprehensive ballistic missile system has still been around for a long time, and it's been reinvigorated under Bush. And I'm afraid it's been maintained under Obama as well. Now, I won't go into the whole system, but it's basically there's a whole range of systems that have been put in place. Some of them are missiles, and some of them are satellite sort of protection and identification systems. And Menwith Hill's role is in that, really. The space-based infrared system is essentially satellites that can identify the early stages of a missile launch and the trajectory of the launch. So the satellite communicates that information to Menwith Hill, should the launch be taking place. And then Menwith Hill will transfer that information to Fort Meade and to the General Communication Center for all the anti-ballistic missile operations in the United States. So theoretically, they can start launching missiles, anti-ballistic missiles, to bring down those missiles using the information from Menwith Hill. And that's a very big project. It's last estimate is about $17 billion for this space-based infrared system. And Menwith Hill is an integral part of that. So it's really intimately involved in the militarization of space as well. And it's very destabilizing. If you think about it, I mean, it's not surprising that countries like Russia are saying, well, if you try and create an active ballistic missile system, we'll increase the number of missiles that we've got to try and stop you from having what they would see as a first strike capability. You see where I'm going with that? So it's really dangerous in terms of an escalation of another sort of arms race, if you like. And then there's the last one, which is, for me, the most interesting and the least sort of understood at present. But when I started this research, I had a pretty good idea of what was going on at Menwith Hill in terms of the first three elements. But I had really no appreciation of the scale of the investment that's been taking place in Menwith Hill to ensure that it could carry out its fourth main function, which I called intelligence-led warfare. And basically what that means is that there's been a multi-billion dollar investment in a combination of... Oh, it's gone. Hi, John. Yeah, we're just halfway through the presentation. I don't want to spend more than another 10 minutes, quarter an hour, and then the last questions, but it's to ensure that Menwith Hill can play its key role in supporting new forms of American warfare. And here we're talking about things like special operations forces and increasing the use of drones, like remotely controlled weapons that require an intelligence element to them in order to be able to operate effectively. And by that I mean that what the new investment allows the United States forces to do is use a combination of satellite imagery and electronic interceptions to create real-time intelligence about what's going on the ground. Real-time in the sense that they can launch a drone very quickly with that information to virtually anywhere in the world and ensure that they've got the intelligence backup to identify the target at very, very close proximity. Now that's, to me, is a new capability that we've never been aware of with Benwithfield before. And it's partly to do with how the United States wants to project power. You know, Obama doesn't want any more of these grandiose land wars that Bush embarked on. What he's tending to do now is to have special operations forces in a growing number of countries that are carrying out those sorts of operations. But in order for them to do it, they have to have this sort of intelligence backup that Benwithfield provides. We're really concerned about that, because essentially what that means is the United Kingdom is providing a base on its territory for acts of war, and effectively, you know, forms of warfare over which we've had no accountability, over which we've had no debate in Parliament, and we're expected to accept it purely and simply on the basis that the United States can rely on the United Kingdom to cover this with the smokescreen of national security. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're saying, well, we can't talk about this because it's national security. Well, you know, we're saying we have to talk about it. We have to talk about it fairly quickly because it's becoming, well, I think for a lot of people, a serious issue about the Western approach to the military, basically, and a military operation. Okay, now we're going to change tack now. I mean, there's a lot of information there, I appreciate that, and I don't want to pour any more onto you because there's plenty of
stuff in the report that you can look at and hopefully sort of ingest, if you like, or digest, whatever. So we're going to go on to the economic arguments.
The argument that the base makes is that it's a substantial contributor to the local economy. And it's one of the arguments that you hear very often in the arms industry and the arms sector is that we provide jobs and security to the local people, without which there'd be usually, you know, major economic disruption is the argument. We wanted to test that, so we were looking at some of the figures. And the original figure that isn't on there is from 2009, which was that the base was worth £130 million to the local economy. So we asked a few questions about that, and it was a very difficult process to get any answers. That's one of the interesting things about this, is that they were quite happy to give an overall aggregate figure. But when we asked them to say how they calculated it, they were less forthcoming, to be polite. And we were given the categories after lots of to and fro, but we weren't given the figures. And it was only when we asked the parliamentary question that we actually got the figures. And what that figure for 2010, which is obviously the height of the contribution, if you like, of 163 million shows, is that over 50% of that is based on US salaries. Well, there's an obvious problem with that. First of all, that a substantial proportion of those salaries won't be spent at all in the UK. They'll be saved and sent back home to the United States. So there's a whole category that should be taken out of there. And then the other major issue is that the base is run as a US economic enclave. I mean, this is a really important point that needs to be stressed, is that They bring supplies in from the United States, either fly them in or ship them in, into shops and supermarkets and cafes that are run on a dollar economy. They're run as dollar economy. They have no connection at all with the local economy. And it's a major disincentive for the US personnel who work there to actually spend money in the local economy, because it's subsidized. It's basically there on a cost base. So, again, you'd have to calculate the figure for that and take that out of the money that goes into the local economy.
And the other big issue is the construction element, which is, again, £32 million. And they were arguing that's local.
And, again, we asked some parliamentary questions, and we got a list of all the contractors who were paid more than £50,000 through the Ministry of Defence on the big project, which is the Phoenix project, the big building that houses all these supercomputers. And it was clear that most of the contractors weren't local at all. They were national contractors who were part of the UK MOD's sort of central contract base, you know, which you would expect for a complex programme like that. But they were counting that into the amount of money that was being spent in the local economy. So the whole calculation is completely fundamentally flawed. And it's only now that, having had the opportunity to look at the figures, that we could make that case. And we sort of suggested that even allowing for a multiplier effect, which is the indirect contribution once the original money has been spent, and people spend in the local economy as a result of that, it's probably more like 50% of the figure that's on there. So, but we haven't had access to the data, so we can't say for certain how accurate that is. But what we've argued is there should be a proper economic impact assessment, and there isn't. Drag this out, but basically, the other side of the coin, which you never advertise, is the hidden cost to the UK of running US bases. Now, we asked some parliamentary questions and some freedom of information requests as well. And it emerged out of that that the Ministry of Defence has to pay for a lot of the infrastructure costs that go into the base, like electricity and the roadworks and the cabling. And that came to about £7 million minimum over 6 years. Now, they would never acknowledge that in public, but that's the way it is. We found that out from the Freedom of Information request. And in a roundabout way as well, either through a Freedom of Information request or using other sites, we've identified all these other costs, which are never included in the cost-benefit analysis for US bases in the UK, including indirect taxes, customs and excise and VAT, none of that applies on the base. All the goods that have flown in, consumer goods and various other items that have flown in, the Americans don't pay customs and excise or VAT on them. The base doesn't pay any business rate council tax. The interesting thing here, in terms of personal income tax as well, nobody pays income tax, none of the US personnel. That includes the private sector contractors from companies like Lockheed Martin. Now these are some of the richest, most profitable arms corporations in the world. And these guys will be on six-figure salaries in some cases, and they pay no personal tax and they pay no council tax. And there's also policing costs to North Yorkshire Police Authority. We estimate a minimum of £500,000 a year because their armed police will patrol continuously around the base, not inside but around the base. And that's at a time when North Yorkshire police budget is being cut and there's a freeze on recruitment of police. And then there's the ultimate thing is when the base is closed, there are going to be environmental cleanup costs, and those all accrue to the Ministry of Defence and to the local authority. The United States abandons bases when it closes, essentially. And it leaves it up to the sort of indigenous authorities to pick up the pieces, and there'll be a lot of pieces to pick up. Environmental cleanup can come into tens of millions of pounds. So overall, you know, the cost will be tens of millions of pounds a year from the MOD and from the UK facilitating these bases, either directly in terms of infrastructure costs or indirectly through the loss of taxation. And we all know what's happening with public services in this country and the terrible strain there are on public services, which the Americans enjoy without paying any contribution towards. So those are the sorts of questions that are raised in terms of the economic sort of pros and cons, if you like. Well, briefly, and I don't want to spend much more time because I've been on for about half an hour, haven't I? Is what would happen if the base closed? Now that's an interesting question. Usually, you know, there's much wailing and gnashing of teeth and people saying it's always worn to us, it's the end of the world. Well, actually it isn't. If you look at the history of base closures, what you tend to find is that given certain economic circumstances, that it's a very positive message that you can take from that experience. Essentially, what you find is that the base tends to have ancillary skills, and UK personnel who work at the base provide the sort of maintenance and gardening and sort of support work in the cafes, etc. That will be lost. You know, we estimate there'll be about 300 to 350 job losses if the base closed. But accepting there is an interim period where you close the base down and you restructure it and make it available for alternative way, what tends to happen, as we can see from the history of other bases, is that you can have a diversified range of other work that goes on in compensation and an increased base of skills. So that after about a 3 to 5 year period, once these new companies come into on site and start providing local employment, it's almost as if the base never existed. And in some cases, it's very clear that the range of skilled work is much higher than it was traditionally through base work. And we've looked at one example, which is Bad Abing, the other NSA base that I mentioned earlier, which is now closed. For various reasons, the National Security Agency decided to close Bad Abing in 2001. And we think it was partly because of all the terrible publicity that the NSA was getting as a result of the European Parliament report on Echelon. And there was an expectation that the German government might actually close it because of all this controversy over the commercial espionage. So we think the Americans probably anticipated that and decided it would be better from their point of view to say they were closing it rather than getting an official request to close it down. But whatever the circumstances, it was closed in 2001. And a private company took it over. And it's a really interesting example of what can be achieved, I think, in terms of a base reuse program. Because the German central government, federal government, and the state government provided funding to support what was known as the Zero Carbon City project, which is to combine residential and commercial industrial work on site. And trying to achieve these central objectives, which were to eliminate carbon emissions on the site. So the targets were set as part of this national target for reduced emissions. Because the Germans don't want to build nuclear power stations. What they'd much rather do is make sure that there's a much more effective energy efficiency system nationally. Mm-hmm. And these are sort of exemplars, if you like. Bad Abing was used as an example for a base closure and reuse program to show what could happen at a military base. There's a whole list of companies that have gone on the base. Some of them very highly skilled, many in energy efficiency and environmental technologies. They're providing new work for people who were previously employed on the base itself. And there's accommodation and hotels, so there's a residential element as well, which is using solar panels and various other ways of reducing carbon emissions. So that's essentially where we stand with it. You know, you can look at the base as it exists now and say, well, it employs people and therefore it's going to be a negative impact if it closes. So you can look at somewhere like Bad Abing and say, well, if you get your act together as a local authority and working in partnership with central government and the private sector, you can develop something like this in a fairly small, fairly short time scale.
Following Bad Abing's closure, are there any other ones similar to Menlith anywhere in Western Europe?
Not as big as Menlith Hill, not as a spy base. No, it's almost centralised the whole function now that Bad Abing's closed.
So the chances of closing this one in any of our lifetimes is quite low.
Well, it depends on how you want to look at it. I mean, if you're looking at it strategically right now, then you'd say the Americans have got a vested interest in all this investment they've put in. But the Americans are pretty brutal in terms of their strategic requirements are.
If they can find a way of
coordinating this information without using a UK-based facility,
they would much
easier for them. The problem is that they have to have a line of sight communication through the satellites for any of the intercepted signals. So that's why they have a global base.
Yes, right.
Yeah, so that's a present. But technologically, there are arguments that they may be able to bypass that.
Change that, yeah. Yes, sure.
So the point being, I suppose, is if the NSA decide to close it, they will close it. And they will close it very quickly, as we've seen with the Bad Abing example. And yet we're totally exposed because we haven't planned for that eventuality. We don't know exactly what would happen if we had to deal with that as an economic issue. Now, there are all sorts of different ways of looking at it. That's just one example. Some people said they could close it down and relaunch it as a sort of tourist attraction. Yeah. I mean, in a way, you can see what the argument is. You know, if you can have a pop museum in the middle of Sheffield, then why not have a spa-based museum in the middle of Harrogate? You know, it's not my idea. But anyway, I'm just saying that you don't have to sort of subscribe to one particular idea to understand that, you know, economics is a process. You don't just stop just because one facility closes down. It's just that, isn't it? That's the nature of the argument. I think the way they do it, and they're very effective at it, is an implicit threat, basically. Don't talk about the base locally. Don't rock the boat, because you're jeopardising your own futures and your own economic prosperity. That's the way they sell it. And it's invidious. I think it's something that the peace movement has to challenge. It has to challenge very effectively and push very hard that's just a totally, fallacious economic argument. And we can do it. The material's there to challenge it.
How many people live on the base?
Well, some people live on the base, but most people live off base.
Right.
So there's 1,800 US personnel, and the majority of them live off base.
Right.
About two-thirds to three-quarters, probably.
So there is some leakage from there.
Yeah, so that's why we said that if you were estimating the impact of the expenditure, then you would estimate about 50%. Well, it's grown from about 400 originally, and there's about 2,300 people overall, including UK personnel and the MOD police. So it's one of the bigger bases, actually. If you count the dependents as well, you're running into about 3,000, 3,500 people. So it's probably the third biggest base in the UK. Anyway, I've got some other slides, but I don't want to sort of go on to them, because it's about 40 minutes now, isn't it? I always do this. Just sort of run out of time, but I hope there's enough material there for you to ask questions. And the one point I would make is that the whole list of recommendations in the report, but ultimately what we're saying is that from a disarmament perspective and an economic perspective, there's a really strong case to close members all down. Now, when I said that at Harrogate in the launch, there was a certain amount of, But you've got to plant the seed somehow, somewhere. And you've got to sort of challenge the orthodoxy and it's propaganda, essentially, that's being put forward about why mental has to stay the way it is. And that's why it's called lifting the lid. We've opened the lid a bit, we've tried to stare it around and get the debate going. And hopefully, if that's the level that we're operating at, I think that's a really important function. And I genuinely believe we can close the base down. I wouldn't be doing these sorts of presentations, and I wouldn't have been involved in it with all the good people who've worked on it if I didn't think we could close it down. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just feel free to ask questions. I don't think I need to come up for a
question.
No,
what's the percentage of security regarding us living near to Manor Hill? I'm in the Doncaster,
yes,
which used to be threatened, because it had RAF Finningley, and we lived within the area of a bomb going off.
Yeah.
Now, it's only about 60 miles away from here. So we're going to get whatever.
I see what you mean. I think if you were looking at it from the perspective of, say, the Russians or potential adversary, you look at Menlo Point and say that's in their centre, and you'd have to take that out. If there was some sort of military exchange, God forbid there was, but then Menlo Point would be one of the key targets, and it would probably be a key target for nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And I don't personally think we should be looking at that in terms of how we judge Menlo Point, because it's just part of the system. It's a very important part of the system. But we're all targets, wherever we live. It doesn't matter if you're 5 miles from Manorville or 5 miles from Palmer. Everybody is vulnerable. under the system that we live in. The argument, I think, should be, what does the UK see itself as in terms of its strategic contributions in the world? Is it just a lapdog in the United States? Or does it have its own identity, its own way of looking at the world, which is different? And that's where Menwithfield falls down dramatically, as far as I'm concerned, because it's the embodiment of, you know, the UK's complete and utter sort of subservience to the United States. I can't think of any other better example of it. So there's that side of it. The other side of the coin is actually, in terms of security, you know, there are armed patrols by the North Yorkshire Police around the base, and they can stop and search people. And there's some very, very heavy sort of security issues now under the legislation. If you try and get onto the base under SCOPA, which I've forgotten what that means, but it's basically a serious crime of police
organised
police. Yeah, thank you. It means that you can be charged with a serious trespass on an area of national security,
mm-hmm.
and you can be put away for 51 weeks just for walking onto the earth and fined, I think, the minimum of £5,000 for what would have been a normal sort of, just a normal trespass. So those sorts of things are ongoing with places like Menwithfield, and I think they reflect the other side of the coin of this issue, which I haven't touched on, I would have wanted to touch on, is the whole issue of invasion of privacy, you know, because these facilities now have the capacity to intercept virtually every form of electronic communication, including private telephone calls. So there's individual rights to privacy that have been completely ignored now and abused. But also there's a collective thing as well. I think there's a sort of intimidation of people when they try and come together to demonstrate nowadays. And, you know, there's Kettling and all this other stuff. And they can identify people before demonstrations happen, and they pick on people before they get there, and they identify them through this intelligence. So, sorry, it's a long-winded answer to your question, but there's two national security and the sort of local sort of policing.
But the thing is, to close it down, you like that German place, their public opinion must have shut it down.
Yes.
So, you know, we've got to relate to it, and the most obvious one is fear. If it's a danger, shut it down.
Yeah, I take your point, and I personally disagree. As I say, I think there's more positive ways of trying to generate support for a disarmament program in which Menwithfield is closed down. And I understand why you want to flag up the issue of what would happen in terms of, the international situation is very grim.
That's how Joe Public looked at it. Why would it affect me? If it's going to ruin my life, then I'm bothered, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think in Germany it was a bit of self-interest as well, because it was commercial espionage, and people were really hacked up about the idea that their companies were losing out on big contracts because the United States had this advantage through intelligence. So you can make the case that there's a commercial
dream movement.
Yeah.
I might just pick up a bit on the use of the base in relation to the new forms of warfare and the legality in international law of the British government is actually complicit in the use of drones for extrajudicial killings in Pakistan, Afghanistan, various countries.
Mm.
We know those, one of the drone bases in the RAF Washington, but the intelligence comes via Menwith.
Yes. Yeah.
So, what's the legal position?
Yeah.
And has anybody...
I've got a slide here. I've had a slide, though. Right, okay. Well, let's just look at this example.
I think it raises some of the questions you want to ask, and the legality of it.
This guy, I say guy,
he's a boy.
A guy called Abdul Rahman Al-Awlaki.
Sorry, my
pronunciation's terrible. But
just as an example, you know, when we talk about drone attacks, and we talk about remote control weaponry. You see them on the television, don't you, where they have the targets and they speed up as they get closer and closer to the building, and suddenly there's a splash and there's an explosion. And we don't know usually what's happened. We don't know who's in there, we don't know the history of them, we don't know the background, we're just told these are terrorists or these are insurgents, and we're supposed to take all that for granted.
And this young man was killed by a drone attack, and he left 9 people dead in southern eastern Yemen. And I've said November 2011, it might have been October, so I need to check on that, but basically it was quite late last year, so it's quite recent. Now you won't have probably heard of him, but you might have heard of his dad, Awalaki,
Abdul Awalaki, who was the sort of second after Osama bin Laden in the most wanted list of the United States. And he was an interesting character because he was a US citizen. And he'd become, well, famous or infamous, particularly in the United States, because he was advocating Muslim resistance around the world, armed resistance against the United States. And he was a very eloquent speaker, apparently. And they once wanted him dead. And a week before this attack, they identified him and, in a similar drone attack, killed him and I think 3 other people in a truck. And amidst much celebration in the United States, because after Osama bin Laden, this guy was seen as the second most important target. And the interesting thing from the United States perspective is that if you're a US citizen, you're supposed to be entitled to your day in court. Mm-hmm. And you're supposed to be able to defend yourself in court against any charge. Now, the charge of inciting people to murder is a significant charge, but he should have been arrested, he should have been taken back to the United States, and he should have been given his day in court. But he was blown away. Now, the United States will claim that they've got a legal right to do that. And there are legal precedents, they say, for being able to put that forward in terms of the national emergency of terrorism. So, if you talk to a legal expert about this, an armed legal expert, they would say that there's absolutely no basis in international law for that. Because if you think about it, what are the implications if everybody decides that somebody who's your enemy, who's in another country, of which you have no jurisdiction, is taken out by your forces, either special operations or through drone attacks, through remotely controlled weapons. This young man was sat with his friends, apparently, just in the moonlight, having a barbecue, and then the drone missile came and took him and his, killed him and his congregation, several other teenagers. Now, we know about this because it became news in the United States. It's not like the other reports. It's not. It doesn't disappear because we don't know the history of these people. Because he was the son, he had a US citizenship. He had a passport. He had a school record. And the original story was that he was a 21-year-old who was already involved in terrorism. And then that whole story collapsed, because we had a history to refer to, a history we don't normally get with these sorts of situations. And they were 16-year-old. They probably claimed in the United States that there were terrorists in the area and they had to carry out this operation. But, you know, it's literally a thunderbolt from the sky. You know, what would happen if it came out of the sky in South Yorkshire now? And took out a 16-year-old that was one of our children. I mean, how will we respond to that? There's a whole terminology now, you know.
Culture.
Well, the reaction against the United States and the West in general from these sorts of attacks is utterly predictable. It's far from helping secure the world, it's adding to our insecurity. It's ridiculous. Destructive way of looking at the world, and we've got to sort of challenge it again. So, sorry, again, it's a roundabout answer, but I think international law has got to look at this much more carefully.
Because the British intelligence services have got an idea of what goes, or a detailed knowledge of what goes on, or do they really just leave the Americans to it?
Well, there is what's known as a sort of intelligence relationship. It goes back to the 40s and 50s.
Well, I know about that, but they'll be told what they want to, to hear. But
yeah, but do you see,
they actually know what's going on in detail about the intercepted communications? In which case, might it be an advantage that it's here rather than in a different country?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, because GCHQ, our intelligence service, has an ongoing relationship with the NSA and Menwood Hill. It has a presence at Menwood Hill. We're not sure how many, because it's you know, secret, but we think it's at least 60 to 100 GCHQ operatives at Menwood Hill. And they will be involved in the sharing of information, but it's very much at the bidding of the United States, because they're the ones who control the technology. So they will be the ones who decide what level of information is passed on. And
that's been clearly true of the space technology, but the cable technologies that are being accessed, GCHQ could play a much bigger role in.
Yeah, well, again, it's one of the areas that we couldn't cover effectively in the report as well as we could.
I'm sure they're not giving it out.
Because they don't give it out, and because it would open up another level of analysis. And I'd have to refer back to Duncan Campbell's work, I think, because he's done some very, very good work on the relationship between GCHQ and the NSA and the UK and in Europe generally. And I suppose the point being, strategically, it does benefit the United States that there is a sovereign government, in effect, that they can rely on, that's independent of any scrutiny that might be in the United States as well. Although I don't subscribe to that very strongly, because I think basically the National Security Agency is run essentially as its own autonomous organisation. Yeah, I think it's almost like a parallel secret state now. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the figures, they're extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. Again, I wasn't really aware of the extent of it. You know, they have about 60 to 70,000 operatives now, National Security Agency, as a total figure. And the budget just for the NSA is about $15 billion. And when you count that up with the National Reconnaissance Office, which is responsible for the satellites and the satellite technology and the imagery that supports the electronic surveillance, it's about $30 billion. You know, we're getting very close to the amount of money the UK spends as a total on the military. And that's for the secret services of the United States. And there are real concerns now in the United States about what's going on in terms of the encroachment on civil liberties. I mean, I think it was Ron Paul, who's one of the Republican candidates, who described there was a new... It's a complicated process, but there's a sort of Defence Authorisation Act that has to be gone through every year. And one of the elements of the Authorisation Act in January this year was to accept that the military could arrest people in the United States and hold them without trial for investigation if they were seen as terrorists. Now that, he described as a form of martial law. It's never been done before in civil society in the United States. The Constitution is supposed to protect you, fundamental, basic human rights. And these things are going on. And it's very easy, if you're not careful, to see a situation where you've got this combination of the Secret Service, which has all these extraordinary powers now to accumulate information and access information. You combine it with those sorts of authoritarian forms of legislation. And you have the basic sort of mechanisms for an authoritarian state that would take over and gradually or possibly quickly destroy the democratic functions of what we consider to be normal representative government. That might be alarmist, I don't know, but I just don't think we're really clear yet about the implications of this accumulation of power by the Secret Service and how men will feel represents that. I'm going to say something really nasty now about Menwood Hill, because I think it needs to be said. If you look at those
balls, those white, pristine, passive little balls on the landscape. And some people seem to like them, actually. Some people think they're actually quite a nice effect. Well, I think you should change that. I think every time you look at them, you should see a stream of blood coming down those river banks. And that stream of blood creates a river of blood. And that river of blood flows down the meadows and the moors into Harrogate. And that should be the representation of Menwood. It shouldn't be.
Just ask for some non-violent direct action. Somebody didn't break in.
Yeah.
Beat that machine.
Absolutely. That's what needs to be done. I'm serious about that. I'm serious about the idea that we're passive about what seems to be a receptor. It doesn't do anything. It just receives. It receives information. You know. And it's all part of a nice package of national security that we shouldn't really think about so much. Well, you know, people like our 16-year-old there are being killed on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And they're being killed as a result of the information that provided by Men with Hill for these new forms of warfare. So I'm sorry, you know, I don't want to get too heavy about it, but you know, I think we're reaching a stage where we have to make some serious sort of consideration about what's going on at the time.
Could we take the sort of to explore the technical thinking a little bit further?
Sure, yeah.
Because I think about, for instance, WikiLeaks, and there are lots of kind of people who work on different bits of technology in different sort of isolated places, and they crack codes and they break into things.
Yes.
And they change it. Now, the not necessarily for the good, and anybody or any government can do the same thing. Now, the drone, as I understand it, both the British and the American government are looking to develop the drone technology to the point at which it doesn't even require a human trigger to say yes. It works on a preset intelligence.
Yes.
That intelligence responds with the set response to the intelligence it receives. That seems to me to be really alarming, because it means we've got to robot wars where the whole thing runs out of control and could decide that human beings would be a bit of a nuisance, read the fear factor, and destroy the lot. But it also seems to me that all this elaborate technology is also open to both individuals and foreign governments to infiltrate, pervert, whatever, to the destruction of the countries which are actually using it, which maybe they deserve, if you see what I mean. But you know, the potential in the future is that all of this is actually way beyond anybody's control.
So I answer that question and come back to you, or do you want to?
Well, I was just going to pick up on that.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Well, I mean, I actually think that the sooner that happens, the better. I mean, I think all the ICBMs in the world are only going to get decommissioned when they're just no longer safe in any way for any government to actually have them. And, you know, as soon as drones do start to get taken over by hackers and turned around and flown into the bases where they originated from, and maybe that's when they'll, you know, stop producing them. And I mean, it would be nice if we could get rid of them all before that starts to happen. But you know, I fear that that's maybe the only way we're going to see an end to it. And so when it becomes so apparent that these things cannot be made safe. I mean, they're clearly not safe now. They're being used to blow children to bits. But, you know, the sooner all these systems are kind of made completely wide open, I think the sooner it'll be clear that all this technology has just got to be got rid of, and we just need to, you know, devote ourselves to peace and not to destruction.
Yeah, I think that's a really... I mean, I think there's all sorts of levels at which you can think about these issues. I mean, for me, the first thing, as I said, when I started this research, I was aware of the capabilities of Menwood Hill, but never fully appreciated the scale of the investment that was going on to support this. And it's not science fiction. It's the thing. These aren't weapon systems that are coming online 30, 40 years down the line. These are systems like the drones that are technologically capable now of being sort of sent anywhere in the world, you know, quite literally from command and control centres.
Just to take up a point, just on the technical point about this drone, you've sort of majored on this throughout the discussion, really.
Yeah.
Members could have two different, or many more perhaps, but I mean, there's the business of the gathering of intelligence to, as it were, advise military operation.
Yes.
And then there's the business of actually operationally controlling the drones for their raids. Are you suggesting that Menwis is directly involved in the latter? For example, the live feeds of the actual attack and so on and so forth. I understood this was done differently.
Yeah, well, that's the key, one of the key things that we need to develop, and one of the important points that we make in the report is that we need to have a much better understanding of the relationship with Men and Pale Hearts in terms of applying its intelligence to these real-time live operations where they're using. Because I think you shouldn't just focus on drones. I think special operation forces as well, and covert warfare is the overarching thing. You've got to. I think it's a question of acknowledging that the actual operation itself has taken a whole range of intelligence supports to get to the stage where they're going in to do something, you know, whether it's to assassinate Osama bin Laden or set a drone off. And that essentially what Menwith Hill does is it coordinates the sort of support intelligence that allows the operatives of the drones or in the special operations forces to actually take over on the ground, or whether it's from the drone headquarters. And then it will feed back information as well while that operation is ongoing. Now, I think that's a really interesting area to look at. And we're hoping that we can do some more research on this, because you know it's going to be difficult to do it. But I think it's one of the key issues that's come out of the report that we need to sort of investigate further. But it is a key point, and I agree. We're not absolutely certain exactly what that
relationship is.
If there is a line at all. But I think if you think of Menwith Hill as like the nerve centre, you know, and we have different nerve centres around the body, but this is, in terms of these new military operations, it's a key nerve centre, and we can start to tease out a bit more what those relationships are. Coming back to the point about, I mean, it's automated warfare. And if you take the human element out of it, what you end up with, as far as I understand, is these algorithms where people decide how many civilian casualties are sort of legitimate in terms of the importance of the target that they're trying to take out. So they actually embody the idea that somehow we can classify civilian casualties as an acceptable, you know, collateral damage. You remember that terrible term from the Vietnam War? In the context of this new form of warfare. I've got a quote here. Sorry, I must be in a bad mood tonight, because I just keep coming up with quotes about horrible things.
This is you to come and talk about the subject.
No, but it's just like, you know, I've been doing this on and off for about 20 odd years, and it still bothers me. You know, that I have to deal with this as a sort of language. You know what? I'm not. You know, it gets to me, I'm afraid. You know, I really get cross about it. Anyway, this is about an airstrike. And it's by a CIA officer. I think it's Algeria's. Is that Algeria's? The television news.
Algeria.
People have seen an airstrike live on a monitor, described it as both awe-inspiring and horrifying. CIA officer watched the carnage on a small monitor in the field. Bleeding human beings running for cover are such a common sight that they have inspired the slang term squirters. Squirters. That's what people are in the algorithms.
the squirters. They don't count. How can anyone say that's awe-inspiring?
You mean like being squirted on?
No, because of their injuries.
They squirt when you squat them.
There's a blood pouring out from their injuries, isn't
it? They're running away with serious wounds. And every time this happens, the Americans deny there are civilian casualties. They deny it. Until it's absolutely clear that there have been civilian casualties. And then they say, oh, it's because it was part of a military operation and they were in a command and control centre or they were near a communications centre. And that's the way it's legitimised. These are people. You know, these are people. Sorry, there was a question just now.
I was going to say, it's worse than denying it. It's, you know, you look at something like collateral murder, the video that was released by WikiLeaks of kind of reporters and other civilians being gunned down, children being kind of shot up in a van by Apache gunships. And it's the people that leaked the information about these war crimes that are being held in solitary confinement, like Bradley Manning, and are probably going to get life imprisonment. If they manage to extradite Julian Assange to the US, I wouldn't be surprised if they try and execute them. And so it's the people that are blowing the whistle on the murder and the war crimes that are being locked up. The people committing the atrocities are being, you know, whisked out of the countries to make sure they don't get prosecuted and protected. Unless, if you commit the atrocities, and that's fine. If you let anyone know that these atrocities are happening, then you can be looking at least life imprisonment.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, that's the situation. That's the reality of the empire.
It's imperial power.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Much earlier on, you talked about getting them to pull out, you know, of men with
yes.
you. Isn't this rather optimistic? I mean, if they've been thrown out of Germany at a bad, they're not going to leave, are they?
Well,
if this is, there's nowhere else for them to go with this thing that they've got, and they're obviously very important. I don't see how you saw this realistic.
Well, it's one of those situations where you decide. Do you just passively let them go on the way they are? Or do you challenge them? And politically, you can challenge them. And I think that it's an important part of the peace movement. I mean, the peace movement generally wants to see the elimination of nuclear weapons, and we all support that. And I think the point I'm trying to make in this Men with Hill presentation and the report is that actually this is an integral part of an imperial system that needs to be closed down.
Sure.
And it's important for us to campaign on that issue, as it is to campaign about nuclear weapons. So that's part of the reason. I understand what you're saying is because of the strategic importance that America attaches to Men with Hill, they're not going to give up without a fight.
No.
Well, that's fine. You know, let's bring it on. You know, that's the way it should be. You know, Okinawa, somewhere like that, you go out on the streets with 50,000 people demonstrating against the bases in Okinawa in Japan. You know, there's all sorts of campaigns going on around the world, and although Men with Hill hasn't, for various reasons, recently been the focus of campaigns, I know for a fact that there's a sort of action group being set up in Harrogate as a result of the public meeting and other activities, and Don can sort of fill you in on that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other campaigning activities going on about Men with Hill, so, you know, the fight back. And we'll see where we get. I would say, if I didn't believe it, I think you can build up momentum in such a way that the Americans feel so threatened about its overall impact that from their point of view, it would be better if they left, because they don't want the controversy and they don't want the stirring of the pot and allowing people to see what range of activities they're involved in the UK. So they, if it got to the stage where they were really under pressure, they would move out and they'd find some other strategic way. Even if it meant spending another $20 billion, another facility somewhere else, that's what they'd do. Well, I'd rather they didn't do it.
That is the point.
Yeah.
I mean, they have been thrown out of bases all over the world. They've established more bases in the last 20 years than they've been thrown out on, I suspect. and this is not a particularly large one by their standards. I mean, they have more people in the American embassy in Iraq by about a factor of 10 than they have at this place in Nambeth. So, I mean, to take it, the fact that they closed Nambeth will only mean that they've managed to transfer the function either to the United States or to some other part
of the world. Well, in itself, it would be, that would be really it would be
a disappointing outcome for them. It would be good for us in terms of consciousness raising about the issues and about pushing them back. Mm-hmm. I don't deny it for a moment.
Yeah.
But in strategic terms, it would be meaningless.
Unless it was part of a disarmament program that closed all of us.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And that's the other element that we need to think about.
One of the things that seems to me is extremely important is to try to reclaim language.
Yes.
Because the language in which people talk today is the language of war games, mm-hmm. which is fine because that's on computers and distant. But if anybody tries to, for instance, draw an analogy to what the Nazis did, if you consider what happened to Baroness Tom, who got thrown out of this. A Liberal Party withdrawn in the Lords for daring to say that the state of Israel was by its actions making its own long life somewhat doubtful. That was an unacceptable thing to say. What the Americans are doing in terms of assassinations with their drones is very similar to Nazi killings. It may not be in camps where people are gassed, but still swathes of people are killed. And it might be a good idea if we actually upped the emotional push of our language a bit to describe what's going on. Because otherwise people don't recognise what is happening. They don't recognise that people, just because they're not our children, they're being assassinated.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's a descendants.
I'm really sorry, but we need to be out of the building by
now. Okay, well,
really sorry to stop the discussion because it's fascinating.
Could Dom just say a few words? Because I know he's.
I've brought copies of the report for everybody to take away, so there's plenty here, and it is also available on the Yorkshire CMD website, downloadable free. Well, obviously, we are asking for a donation if possible. There's a few, there's actually lots of things I wanted to say about the drone issue because it's very interesting, but I will just suggest if you are interested in following that up, have a look at the Drone Wars UK website. It's very good, and there's a lot of information on there. There's also a legal case going on at the moment where William Hague is being taken to court about a drone strike in Pakistan, which DCHQ has alleged provided locational intelligence for a bottle. We don't know yet. So that's all very relevant. Some events coming up, I saw it was on your minutes already, actually. We do have a peace walk going on Sunday. Up at Nenwith Hill, if anybody would like to come and join us. We're setting up at 12 o'clock in the late night opposite the pub. Please do come along and bring a packed lunch. But more importantly, or rather larger, we're planning an action for the Global Day of Action on Military Spending on the Tuesday the 17th of April. And we're hoping to have a temporary peace camp up near Nenwith Hill, which would involve providing workshop spaces for a variety of workshops, such as Steve's talk tonight, hopefully inviting the speakers in to look at all kinds of anti-military topics. Also provide creative spaces for banner making, a few other creative types of actions, and to finish the day off by going around to the grounds of the base, taking hopefully with us some peace banners and showing that there is a viable alternative to having a base there. It would be really good to get, I know it's a Tuesday, it's going to be difficult for people, but it would be really good to get, you know, people coming along, getting involved in that, and we already have interest from the media. It's already a big issue, it's in people's minds, and people in the local area now are beginning to question it, and they haven't before. So I think, like Steve was saying, it's kind of our it's for us in the peace movement to kind of take some of this information out there and hopefully engage more people in questioning what is actually going on with the campaign.
Can everybody make sure that I've got your contact so that when Dominic contacts me with information around these events, I can pass it on to you? And we do have spaces, we are going up to Waddington. The reason for that is that the pilots are going to be trained at Waddington for flying the drone. Yes, so we're going up to Waddington on the 3rd of April. If you want to join us, let me know. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.